Welcome to the media ministry of the Bible Church of Brownsburg. The teacher for this message is Pastor Paul Lidke.
If you would turn in your Bibles this morning to Hosea 7, this book from the minor prophet on that very love, the unfailing love of God. It's not always so obvious to us as we progress through chapter by chapter, but there is pictures of his love throughout this book. Came across a quote. My wife was reading a book and she brought this to my attention as she was reading it. I thought it was very appropriate for our study of Hosea. It's a quote from Dr. Martin Lloyd Jones, that faithful English pastor. And in fact, if I'm correct, I think even this past week was an anniversary of his homegoing to the Lord. He wrote this in his book entitled Seeking the Face of God, Nine Reflections of the Psalms. And he said this, "You will never make yourself feel you are a sinner because there's a mechanism in you as a result of sin that will always be defending you against every accusation. We are all on very good terms with ourselves. And we can always put up a good case for ourselves, even if we try to make ourselves feel that we are sinners. We'll never do it. There's only one way to know that we are sinners, and that is to have some dim, glimmering conception of God." I thought that was a wonderful quote, a wonderful observation on the human condition. Really a wonderful thought to keep in our minds as to why we are going to continue on in this study of Hosea. We are predisposed to cut ourselves some slack when it comes to the indwelling sin that is within us. Absent the work and the work word of God, we would choose to not see our sin. We would choose to defend our sin. We would see ourselves as better than we are. Well, any serious study of this book will shatter that perception. When we began this study, we realized that one of the challenges was trying to see which person that we would identify with in Hosea. And I hope by now that we've all come to the conclusion that of all of the characters here in Hosea's book, we are most like Israel. We follow in their footsteps. And so, as we continue on in chapter 7 this morning, we come really to a picture of what it looks like when a nation forsakes God. When a nation forsakes God. Each chapter in Hosea gives just a little bit of a different perspective on who we are in relationship to a holy God. Chapter 7 is very self-contained. We live in a day and an age where if you are not the best of cooks, or if you would simply prefer to avoid that labor in your home, you can sign up for a service. And you can have a meal delivered to your doorstep with every ingredient that you will need to make a tasty meal for yourself, all in a single box. Everything's there. The spices are there, the instructions are there, the meal is there, all in one box. All you got to do is follow the directions. Hosea chapter 7 is kind of like that service to us this morning. Everything we need to understand its message is found in these 16 verses. It'll give us its own introduction, its own content. You'll notice in particular this morning that God goes out of his way to give multiple illustrations this morning so that those who hear these words would understand exactly what he means when he's saying them, and then it will also provide its own conclusion. When a nation forsakes God. Now, I've chosen that term specifically this morning, forsaking, because the context here is that of apostasy. Apostasy. An apostate is one who at some previous time has known God. At some time in their past, they have actually been in some level of fellowship with him, been aligned with him, but has now gone astray, who has now in the moment defected from that relationship, has become a traitor to him. That apostasy, that forsaking, is exactly where we find Israel this morning. Not every person that lives will be an apostate, because not everyone will have been brought into some level of fellowship with him, exposure to him. But for those that are, there is greater condemnation when they reject him. And so this morning, we'll find in these verses three marks of a nation that forsakes God. Three marks of a nation that forsakes God. And anything in what you hear this morning that parallels to our day is only a reflection of the condition of the commonness of the human heart. We are not Israel. There's only one nation of God. But when a people collectively choose to turn their back on God, they follow a familiar path. And so this morning we find these three marks in Hosea 7. The first is this: the nation forsakes the sovereignty of God for self-determination. They forsake the sovereignty of God for self-determination. We'll find that in the first seven verses of this chapter. Secondly, a nation will forsake the security of God for self-defense. Forsake the security of God for self-defense. That will be revealed to us in verses 8 through 12. And finally, a nation will forsake the salvation of God. Forsake the salvation of God for self-deceit. The three marks of a nation that forsake God is that they forsake the sovereignty of God for self-determination, they forsake the security of God for self-defense, and they forsake the salvation of God for self-deceit. Let's begin in verse 1 of chapter 7. Under this first mark, forsaking the sovereignty of God for self-determination. Now I'm going to begin with this last half of verse 11 of chapter 6, because it seems to tie better with the thought going forward than it does with the thought looking backward. See if you can identify the parallel here in this verse as I read. When I restore the fortunes of my people, verse 11, when I would heal Israel, verse 1, the iniquity of Ephraim is uncovered and the evil deeds of Samaria. For they deal falsely. The thief enters in, bandits raid outside. I want you to note the spiritual principle that is laid out here. Iniquity and evil, sin must be dealt with first before restoration and healing can occur. God is saying that he is willing to restore the fortunes of his people, to heal Israel. But there's something that's standing in the way. Their iniquity and their evil deeds. Iniquity, again, that term that speaks of bending or twisting, like a broken bone. Poor Donna has experienced that this week. A broken bone in her arm that caused her shoulder to be twisted as one end was going in a different direction than the other. How do you heal that? Well, the first thing that you have to do is you have to set it, right? You have to put it into alignment before it can heal. A nation cannot be made right with the merciful God that is willing to heal, that is willing to restore, until they repent of their sin. That's where God begins here in chapter 7. Are they willing to do this? What's their status? What does he say? For they deal falsely. They're not straightforward with God. And as a result, the thief enters in and bandits raid outside. They're deceitful both from within and without. The thief from the inside, the raider or bandit from the out. What is Israel's condition? They've forsaken their God. They've chosen to deal with him falsely. And he continues in verse 2, they do not consider in their hearts that I remember all their wickedness. Now their deeds are all around them. They are before my face. How does a nation get to this point? How do they justify this belief, this approach to God? How did a nation that at one time was in fellowship with God so quiet their conscience that they can now behave in such a way without believing or being affected by it? Well, they've stopped reminding themselves. They've stopped speaking to their inner man that God clearly sees them. That nothing escapes his attention. They pretend as if they're not associated with the wickedness that is all around them. And they can pretend that God doesn't see it, but it is indeed ever before his face. It's right in front of him. It's obvious. Israel is justifying their separation from God by quelling their conscience and never reminding themselves that God is seeing everything they're doing. David in Psalm 139 says, O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit up and when I rise up. You understand my thought from afar. You scrutinize my path and my lying down. You are intimately acquainted with all my ways. Even before there is a word on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it all. Now that's going to be taken one of two ways. For the one who is walking with God, that's a comfort, right? That's a comfort that he knows even those things that we are unable to speak. Like we can't even explain it. We don't even have the words to be able to share the grief, the despair of our hearts. But he knows. He understands. He sees us. He is willing to help us. But to the one who has walked away from him, Those are condemning words. You think that you can leave God and that he will never know and never see what you're doing. David is saying that's not the truth. You may be clinging to that lie, but just because you perceive it to be reality doesn't mean that that is what is true. It would be like me finding a mirror that makes me look very skinny and then believing that that was the case. I would be not in reality, right? And that's where Israel's at. They have believed that lie, that they are seeing themselves correctly and God doesn't see. They have forsaken God's sovereign vision. They've forsaken his rule. Verse 3, with their wickedness, they make the king glad and the princes with their lies. What's the evidence that this is going on in their hearts? The evidence of this self-governance, this self-determination. Well, notice that over these next few verses, God is going to be speaking about the leadership of the nation. In verse 3, he speaks of kings and princes. In verse 5, the day of our king, the princes. In verse 7, the rulers and the kings. God is speaking of leaders. He's talking about what's happening at the top of the political food chain here. And in verse 3, he is describing a culture of kissing up to political leaders, placating them with lies. Their wickedness, they make the king glad and the prince with their lies. Why would someone do this? Why would someone intentionally speak to political leaders, to the highest in the land, but not tell them the truth? Well, there could be several motivations. You could be trying to momentarily placate them in order to curry favor with them. You could be momentarily trying to maintain your position of influence, willing to say whatever is necessary. You could be simply wanting to push your own agenda. This sort of behavior is what the human heart produces when all it's concerned about is simply maintaining power, when it wants to govern itself, when it wants to determine itself what your life is going to be life like. It's a mindset that says, I will say whatever is needed in order to move ahead. I'm going to tell you what you want to hear, is how we describe it today. Short-term thinking. It's being more concerned about pleasing men than pleasing God. Several weeks ago, I made reference to the account in 1 Kings 22, how one of the northern kingdom's most infamous kings, Ahab, wanted to go to war with the southern kingdom's king, Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, against Aram. This is not the first time that Ahab wanted to pursue this war. And so they brought in the prophets. You recall the story. This is what the prophets said to the kings when they sought their counsel. The king of Israel gathered the prophets together, about 400 men, and said to them, "Shall I go against Ramoth Gilead to battle, or so shall I refrain?" They said, "Go up, for the Lord will give it into the hand of the king." Jehoshaphat wasn't quite so sure that these prophets had his best interest at heart. And so he said in verse 7, "Is there not yet a prophet of the Lord here that we may inquire of him?" Well, You go down to verse 10 of 1 Kings 22. The king of Israel, Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, were sitting each on the throne, arrayed in their robes. All the prophets were prophesying before them. Zedekiah, the son of Chenaanah, made horns of iron for himself and says, "Thus says the Lord, with these you shall gore the Arameans until they're consumed." And the prophets were prophesying, saying, "Go up to Ramoth-Gilead and prosper, for the Lord will give it into the hand of the king." But then the prophet of the Lord is called Micaiah. And in verse 17, when he's asked, after they finally drag it out of him, he says, "I saw all Israel scattered on the mountains like sheep who have no shepherd. The Lord said, 'These have no master. Let each of them return to his house in peace.'" Then the king of Israel, Ahab, said to Jehoshaphat, "Did I not tell you he would not prophesy good concerning me? I told you. I told you he wasn't going to give me good news." Micaiah said, "Therefore, hear the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne, all the host of heaven standing by him on his right and his left. The Lord said, 'Who will entice Ahab to go and fall at Ramoth-Gilead?' And one said this, while another said that. And then a spirit came forward and stood before the Lord and said, 'I will entice him.' The Lord said to him, 'How?' And he said, 'I will go out and be a deceiving spirit in the mouth of his prophets.' And he said, 'You are to entice him and also prevail. Go and do so.' Behold, the Lord put a deceiving spirit in the mouth of these your prophets, and the Lord has proclaimed disaster against you." These that were seeking to curry favor, to say what the king wanted to hear, were deceivers. They had no fear of the Lord. Verse 4, not only that, they're adulterers. Like an oven heated by the baker who ceases to stir up the fire from the kneading of the dough until it's leavened. And here we get, again, I told you, everything is self-contained here. In chapter 7, we get the first illustration that God gives to help us understand what the situation is like. He gives us this picture. He begins by placing into our minds this picture of unfaithfulness and adultery. And so this unfaithfulness is the theme of this illustration. And then you have this image of heat. He speaks of ovens and bakers and bread and the heat that is needed to rise the bread in a baker's oven. What's really being spoken of here is the heat of political intrigue, conspiracies and coups, the heat of the pursuit of political power. What's the baker doing in this? Like an oven heated by the baker who ceases, this is the baker, to stir up the fire from the kneading of the dough until it's leavened. Well, I'm not that great of a cook, but I know if you create dough and you need that dough to rise, that dough needs a heat source, right, to activate the yeast so that it will then rise and then be useful for you to then cook it as bread. The job of the baker is to make sure that there is a consistent heat source so that that dough could rise. But what does the baker do? He ceases to stir up the fire. He's abandoning his post at the most critical time. He's forsaken, and this is the point of the illustration, he's forsaken his duty. He's forsaken his duty. When a nation forsakes the rule and the sovereignty of God, and they want to just do what they want to do, they will forsake their duty, give up their responsibility, become more consumed with the politics and the intrigue than his job. He would rather have the freedom to simply act on his own. He doesn't believe he's going to have to answer to anybody for the fact that the dough won't be able to become bread in the morning. So he's willing to give up his post. Verse 5, on the day of our king, the princes become sick with heat of wine and stretched out hand with the scoffer. So it's like God is creating this little movie for us. And he starts with this camera focused on the kitchen with the baker and the oven, and the baker leaves. And now the camera goes to where all the leaders are. Where are they doing? What's going on there in the court? In the day of our king and the day of celebrating the king, the party is on. And the leaders are all drunk. The scoffers of God are all in league together. They're drinking themselves silly. You only do that when you think you're untouchable, when you think you're independent, when you have no idea of any danger. You wouldn't willingly put yourself in that position if you knew that there was danger around the corner, but when you think you're completely safe, you've got no problem drinking yourself into a stupor. And then, verse 6, for their hearts are like an oven as they approach their plotting. Their anger smolders all night, and in the morning it burns like a flaming fire. God, again, gives us another baking, cooking illustration. The camera goes back to the kitchen, but now is looking from a little different perspective. He's saying the hearts are hot like an oven as they're plotting their ambush. They can keep it in check for a while. They can keep their passion, their anger, their murderous desires of the king in check for a while. It smolders at night. But when the oven is opened in the morning, when the fresh oxygen arrives, when the fresh fuel arrives, those smoldering embers become an uncontrollable roaring flame. Have you ever seen that? Have you ever had a fireplace that has a door on it? You put wood in there, and that wood will stay hot all night, but it will burn down to those embers, right? It won't look like it's that hot. But then when it's time to add more fuel and you open the door and it gets more oxygen, you put a little bit of wood on there, and it just explodes. That's exactly the picture that God is painting here. They've gone from maintaining some level of control over their passions, over their plotting, over their desire to seek the throne, and now they've forsaken it. They've forsaken self-control in pursuit of the throne. Verse 7, all of them are like a hot oven. They consume their rulers. All their kings have fallen, and none of them calls on me. This is just a picture of what happened over and over and over again in the northern kingdom of Israel. Kings would rise and kings would fall. Leaders would come, monarchies would come, and then someone would take him out and kill him, and somebody else's family would become king. The heat of the coup would overwhelm everyone in its path. The rulers are torched and removed, and the pathway to the king is clear. The plot succeeds. The king is slain, and a new monarch ascends to the throne. And that's just a cycle, because he says all their kings have fallen. That's the way they fell. This was just par for the course. Political scheming, plots, all originating from a heart that believed that God wasn't paying any attention. They were consumed with grasping the reins of power, and they didn't want God and his sovereign rule over them to get in their way. Any of you are familiar with the Japanese game Botashi? Botashi? If you're taking notes, write that down. When you go home, look up Japanese Botashi. I'm probably not going to be able to do it any good this morning in its description, but we're all familiar with capture the flag, right? Okay. Japanese Botashi is when you have two different teams, dozens of people on each team. One of the individuals on the team stands on the pole. And the goal, it's a simple game, is for one team to knock that individual off the pole. Now, the height of that pole looks like it's maybe about 12 to 14 feet. So the way that you have to get there is you literally have to launch yourself into the crowd and then climb up on top of each other to get enough of a base so that someone can come rushing in and then get to the top and knock the person off. Some of the kids are saying this would be kind of fun in youth group. Okay. We would need a much bigger youth group to accomplish this. Okay. That's kind of what's going on here. Just throwing themselves on the pile in hopes that one of them is going to get to the top, knock off the ruler, and then they can rule. They're willing to forsake their sovereign king in order to rule themselves, in order to be able to determine their own rule. The first step in a nation forsaking their God is to behave as if he's not even their sovereign. The second begins in verse 8. They forsake the security of God for self-defense. They forsake the security of God for self-defense. Ephraim mixes himself with the nations. When a nation and its leadership forsake God, they seek to rule themselves outside of God, and they refuse to call upon God for help. So what happens when that nation finds itself in the kind of trouble that they don't have the resources to solve? A nation who is designed to be protected by God now decides they're going to have their own security. What happens when they face an enemy that's beyond their capability to resist? Well, you have to come up with your own solution. You've got to rely on your own wisdom. You've got to come up with a way to defend yourself. And the earthly wisdom whispers in the ear, find another godless nation where your self-interest aligns and form a treaty with them, cut a deal with them. Go find another nation that's thinking exactly like you. Go cut a deal with the devil. It's okay. Isaiah 31, verse 1 says, woe to those who go down to Egypt for help and rely on horses and trust in chariots because they are many, and in horsemen because they are very strong, but they do not look to the Holy One of Israel nor seek the Lord. They're looking for help in all of the foreign nations. They can deal with this on their own. When you've made God your enemy, you seek the warm embrace of the wicked. When you've made God your enemy, you seek the warm embrace of the wicked. You want others that are just going to pat you on the back and tell you it's okay. I'll take care of you. Let's just work together. Does that sound like a good strategy to you? Does that sound smart to you? Doesn't to God either, and that's why he says, look what he says in the last half of verse 8, Ephraim has become a cake not turned. This is the third illustration that God is using here. I told you, he was just going to include them all right in the chapter. We don't need to go outside for him. He's got them right here. Now, we might, in our day, go, well, what's the problem with that? A cake not turned. I have never, once in my life, made a Betty Crocker cake, put it in the oven, and decided 10 minutes in I needed to turn it over. Okay? That's because we have the benefits of modern technology with our ovens. In order to understand what he's saying, think of something that you need to bake or cook that requires cooking it on both sides. Something like a grilled cheese sandwich, right? A grilled cheese sandwich. You flip it over in order to get it completely cooked. But I thought, well, that doesn't really like fit here, because there are some people who would be willing to eat a grilled cheese sandwich only if it was cooked on one side. Well, what about a tortilla? Have you ever seen people who make fresh tortillas, right? They make the dough, they press it down, right? And then you cook both sides of the tortilla so that both will get crispy and soft in the inside. What if you only cooked one side of the tortilla and then said, oh, this is good enough? What if one side was just completely crispy and burned and the other side was just raw dough? What would you say? Is that edible? No. We have a term for that. We would call that half-baked, right? Half-baked. Now, we use the term half-baked to refer to a person or idea that's not thought through, something that's not too bright, something that's not reasonable, and that's exactly the point that God's making here. You're right, it's not smart to take this strategy. They have forsaken reason. Israel forsakes reason when it refuses to call on God and yet seeks help from its idolatrous neighbors rather than relying on their sovereign's protection. Israel is outside their mind to think that this is going to work. And so God describes this mentality further. Verse 9, strangers devour his strength, yet he does not know it. Gray hairs also are sprinkled on him, yet he does not know it. He's describing those that have lack of reason. This lack of reason blinds them to reality. It blinds them to the reality that when they join themselves with foreign nations, these allies are not making them stronger, they're making them weaker. When these allies require them to pay these tributes to them in order to protect them, protection money, it's a protection racket, they're not stronger because of that. They're more vulnerable because of that. That lack of reason extends to how they even view themselves. It blinds them to the weakness of old age. Their gray hairs are sprinkled on them. They begin to age early, and the gray starts popping up in their head, and they pretend that it's not there. They don't even have the ability to see that their hair is turning gray. They're like, I know we've seen them, the proud former athletes who believe that they can compete just as they did when they were 18 with the young athletes in their prime, you know. I'm 55, but I used to be an all-state running back. I think it's perfectly okay for me to play in a tackle football game with 18-year-old high schoolers, right? That's simply foolishness. It's not recognizing that you're older. That age has not made you stronger. It's made you weaker. It's an unwillingness to recognize that you're closer to the end of your lifespan than you are the beginning of your lifespan. And Israel's end was near. Furthermore, verse 10, though the pride of Israel testifies against him, yet they've not returned to the Lord their God, nor have they sought him for all of this. The realities are clear to anyone else who sees it, but their pride, their belief that they can rely on themselves for their own defense is a witness against them. This self-defense mentality serves as a barrier to them. It's preventing them from turning and searching and finding the only one who can protect them. In their blind pride, they're half-baked. They've forsaken the sovereign rule of God. They've forsaken his secure protection, and they just want to believe that they themselves can solve this. They can just rely on their own gumption to get themselves out of it. They're like an angry toddler who picks up and tries to learn a skill for the first time, and when mom and dad try to step in and say, "Help, hey, let me help you," and like, no, I want to do it. I want to do it all on my own. Right? And they'll try to wrangle that thing they'll get upset with themselves, and finally they come to the end of themselves, right? Now, God continues this theme in verse 11. Look, so Ephraim has become like a silly dove. They're not just half-baked. They're like a silly dove without sense. Here's another simile, another illustration. They're a silly, senseless dove. Proverbs 6:32 says, the one who commits adultery with a woman is lacking sense. Unfaithfulness, the one who is unfaithful lacks sense. You want to destroy yourself? That's what you do. What are doves known for? If I were to take a poll this morning and ask you, what's the one thing you might know about doves? What do you know? It was before Valentine's Day, you probably would get this answer. Doves mate for life. They're known for their fidelity. Ephraim is a foolish dove, a dove that lacks a heart, a bird without sense. Like those birds that just keep running into your windows because they see their reflection. I've got one of those, expecting him to turn up any day now. They have forsaken loyalty. They've forsaken loyalty. What makes them senseless? Seeking help from godless nations. They call to Egypt, they go to Assyria. They want to mate with godless nations. One of which is where they were enslaved before, the other of which is where they're about to be captured. So in verse 12, God says, when they go, I will spread my net over them. I will bring them down like birds of the sky. Israel wants its freedom. Israel wants to be let go. Israel wants to be self-reliant, defend themselves, autonomous, not have to be responsible to God, but they can't. And rather than humbly return to the one who loves them, they are looking for help from all the idolatrous nations around them. God is saying, they're seeking freedom, I'm going to capture them. They're seeking safety, they're not going to escape from me. They're trying to run from me, but I'm going to discipline them just like I said I would. I'll chastise them in accordance with the proclamation to their assembly. It's foolish to believe you can defend yourself better than God. And so, Israel has forsaken the sovereignty of God for self-determination. They want to rule themselves rather than surrender to God. They're willing to forsake the security of God for self-defense. Be like saying, listen, I really don't need the Army, the Air Force, the Marines, the Navy, the Coast Guard. I've got my squirt gun. I'll be there on the border when we're about to be invaded. That's the silliness of this approach. Lastly, they forsake the salvation of God for self-deceit. They forsake the salvation of God for self-deceit. I'm going to read the next three verses together and then kind of combine these thoughts. Woe to them, for they have strayed from me. Destruction is theirs, for they have rebelled against me. I would redeem them, but they speak lies against me. They do not cry to me from their heart when they wail on their beds. For the sake of grain and new wine, they assemble themselves. They turn away from me. Although I trained and strengthened their arms, yet they devise evil against me. Against this backdrop of rebellion, God's offer to them is remarkable. I would redeem them, he says, at the end of verse 13. That's ransom language. That's saving language. God's saying is, despite everything, I'm willing to purchase them. I'm willing to go to the slave market and purchase them out of their sin. Indeed, God's love for his people is unfailing. But what do his people do in light of that heart? They forsake the offer. They would rather be placed under his judgment, even though they think it's not coming. They convince themselves they have no need of him. They tell themselves they'll never be judged by him. They deceive themselves by believing they don't need to stay near to him, and so they stray. They depart. They deceive themselves by believing he's not going to harm us, and so they rebel against him. They deceive themselves by believing, oh, he can be fooled, so they lie to him. They deceive themselves by believing he is obligated to them no matter what. And so they cry to him, but just with insincere hearts. They deceive themselves by believing other gods are going to provide for them. And so another word there in verse 14, instead of assemble, you could say they gash themselves. Some of your Bibles might have that note. What it's saying is that rather than trust in God for provision, they're willing to slice themselves up to try to curry favor with false gods so that they can provide for them. Prophets of Baal and Elijah. They deceive themselves by believing that they can forsake their true king. They can remove themselves from his rule. And so they can turn from him and make evil plans against him. God's willing to save them, but they'd rather lie to themselves about their condition and their need. And so God saves his final illustration for verse 16. They turn, but not upward. They're like a deceitful bow. They're not stagnant. It's not like they're just sitting around, lazy. They're on the move. But they're not moving to God. He calls them a deceitful bow. What's that? It'd be like if you had a bow and an arrow and you pulled it back and you knew that your skills were good enough. You knew the arrow was straight. Everything should be working, but every time you shoot it at the target, it's off. It will never shoot straight. It's like a miscalibrated oven. You ladies ever have an oven that says it's at a certain temperature, but then when you put a thermometer in there to test it, it's really a different temperature? That affects the way you cook, right? Be like for you golfers, if you want to go pull out your 9 iron, but it really had the angle of a 2 iron on it, but it said 9. And so you thought you would be chipping onto the green with your 9, and it sails it onto the next tee because it's really a 2. For you non-golfers, the higher the number, the greater the angle on the club. They're a deceitful bow. They're full of deceit. They can't be trusted. They have forsaken truth. They believe they're safe and secure. They believe they've successfully removed God from their consciousness. And in their pride, they have forsaken God. They don't want his sovereignty. They don't want his security. And they're rejecting his salvation. Is his plan going to work? How's it going to go for them? This is where God provides his conclusion. Their princes will fall by the sword because of the insolence of their tongue. Those positions and those leaders that they have sought for, that they have esteemed so highly, are going to be slaughtered. This will be their derision in the land of Egypt. All the foreign nations that they so want to ingratiate themselves to are going to laugh at them. Their national leaders are going to be slaughtered. Their national pride is going to be shattered. God will give them what they want. He'll give them self-determination. He'll say, go ahead, defend yourself. He'll say, believe your lies. And self-determination and self-defense and self-deceit will result in self-destruction. In the end, this chapter is a picture of Romans 1:25. They are exchanging the truth of God for a lie. When a nation forsakes God, they forsake the sovereignty of God for self-determination. They forsake the security of God for self-defense. They forsake the salvation of God for self-deceit. If you want to remember this going forward, you want to, what do I hang my hat on so that I don't forget what God is saying in Hosea 7? Just go back to those illustrations that he uses. He uses 5 of them. An inattentive baker is one who forsakes his duty. A consuming oven is forsaking self-control. A burned cake is forsaking reason. A silly dove is forsaking loyalty. A deceitful bow is forsaking truth. That's what a nation looks like when they forsake God. They don't believe they need to answer to him. They don't believe there needs to be any restraints on them. They're thinking. They're outside of their mind and how they justify their behavior. In the end, they're forsaking truth. So, what about us? What about us this morning? What can we do while living in a nation that clearly is going down and embracing these very same things? A few thoughts as we conclude this morning. Fight the lies. Battle the lies. Israel believed that God would not see or remember their sin. Remember all the way back in verse 2, God's not going to remember this. Fight that lie in your life that God doesn't see your sin. Israel believed the lie that they could harbor small sins and that they wouldn't grow. They can simply just want to overthrow God, but that wasn't going to be a problem. No, overthrowing God led to not wanting him to defend you, led to lying to yourself. Small sins grow. And if you think that you're going to be untainted by your sin, think of that little picture that God gives of someone who's older and gets gray hairs and they're unable to see it. That's what you're like if you refuse to acknowledge your sin. Don't believe the lie that God is not going to judge you. Self-deception only leads to self-destruction. We can be thankful that God is not that way. He is never lied. His Son is the truth. He's the one that was full of truth. He has given us the Spirit of truth that guides us in all truth. If you want to survive in a nation that is bent on forsaking God, don't give in to their lies. Don't give in to their beliefs. Don't adopt their thinking. Cling to Christ. Believe in the sufficiency of God's word and his gospel. Trust and obey.
You have been listening to a message from the Bible Church of Brownsburg. For more information, please visit our website at www.bcb.church or call 317-852-7475.